This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. As you know, we build the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And this week we're discussing feral pigs, and there's a growing number of them now living wild in the Scottish countryside.
Yesterday afternoon, the sun was shining, the birds were singing, it was warm. You know, my daughter and I sat outside and had lunch in the square in Ellen, and it was lovely. Today, I seem to be working with a bundle of clothes with a hat on top. It's cold, it's damp, and I don't blame her in the slightest. Good morning, I'm Mark Stephen, sitting on the other side of the fire here at Beechgrove in Aberdeen, Rachel Stewart.
This will be my attire until at least July.
That's beach wear for you, isn't it?
It is. I was in Highland Perthshire yesterday and was thinking exactly the same thing. It was the start of meteorological spring, and it was gorgeous, sunny and bright. The crocuses all coming up, birds in the sky, just gorgeous. Bit dreich today.
Disappointing.
Yeah, wee bit disappointing.
I'm sure it'll dry up and become lovely later.
I'm sure it will. Are you feeling that it's spring-like now? Have you got big plans for the weekend?
Hard to tell from bed, isn't it?
Let us know. Outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is our email address, or you can text us 80295. Alex is here on 0808 5925 00, answering all your calls, so let us know what your plans are.
We got a right nice email from Derek Ramsey after last week's programme. He says, The programme had to take backstage this morning. The Dawn Chorus has been building up all week. I take my morning walk-size round Keith Hall Estate in Aberdeenshire, and it's so uplifting to hear the birds singing again. It literally puts a spring in your step. You've helped me get out exercising in the morning all winter, but sorry, you can't compete with us.
Derek sent us a recording of the Dawn Chorus out at Keith Hall. Here's a wee burst. We can't compete with that. It's fabulous.
Not really
good. Let's go to another sound now, the one you've all been waiting for, the mystery sound.
That's a good one. Not mechanical either.
Get in touch then, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295 or give us a ring 0808 5 9295 00.
An event's been held in the Highlands this week to discuss how to manage the growing number of feral pigs living wild in the Scottish countryside.
Yeah, experts say that the animals, which are often a cross between wild boar and domestic pigs, can have both positive and negative impacts on the environment. I met Kieran Watson from Forestry Land Scotland and Morag Milne from Nature Scot in some woodland close to Fort Augustus where the animals are known to exist.
It's not necessarily well known, but there are well-established populations of pigs in Scotland, and they come from private ownership, or they've escaped from wild boar farms, or they've been released. So the release is of pigs that come from a mixed genetic origin, wild boar crosses with domestic pigs. And we have animals that look like wild boar, as you might typically imagine, and spotty pigs that look like domestic pigs. So that's why we call them feral pigs. They're not under anybody's ownership or care. They're free-ranging wild and in the wild.
Most of us have probably never seen them. Just describe them for me.
We've got a range of different types. They look like wild boar, dark, hairy pigs. They do have tusks. They do have straight tails and a straighter snout than you might expect with a domestic pig. And domestic pigs come in bring a range of colours to the population that's in Scotland. So we have spotty pigs and we have dark brown, hairy pigs.
I accept that this will be difficult to answer, but have you got any idea how many of them are in the wild in Scotland?
We don't know how many there are. There isn't any monitoring of the wild population. Our best guess is low thousands. And we can expect, if they're not controlled, to extend their range and increase in their number across Scotland.
So what impact then are they having on the environment here?
Their most common sign of pig activity is their rooting behaviour. So they will dig up the vegetation and turn it over, looking for roots, looking for invertebrates. So that disruptive behaviour, if it's sporadic, if there's a low density of pigs, can be beneficial, can bring in an opportunity for a range of plants to set seed and establish in an area where the ground cover is quite dense. So in woodland and with pigs at low density, they can be beneficial. But at high density, that's not the case. Their rooting behaviour is particularly unpopular in agricultural fields, in sports pitches, in people's gardens. So that's the most obvious sign of pig activity, and that will bring them into conflict with people.
My name's Kieran Watson and I'm a wildlife ranger manager for Forestry and Land Scotland.
Have you seen some of these pigs going around yourself?
Yes, yeah. More so recently than in the past. So it definitely has become a lot more prevalent on the roadside. You'll see a lot of roadside pig impact coming up the 82 on the north side of Loch Ness and heading west out of Drumnadh Rocket as well. And that's consequently meant that there's a lot more signs of them and actual noted sightings of them in kind of crofters' fields, smallholders' fields, farmers' fields, etc., down this neck of the woods as well.
What does that impact look like?
So the impact looks like a sizeable excavator has been through a field doing some drainage work or doing some other groundwork in the area. They seem to be quite capable of turning over stones, turning over large logs, turning over large areas of bracken like we've seen here quite quickly in the space of a couple of hours. And so it really does. It's bare soil right down. You know, we've seen instances of them burrowing down 4 or 5 feet. So that obviously has a huge impact on people with kind of smaller fields, smaller sheep fields, etc., that ground is almost unrecoverable from that sort of impact.
In this kind of environment, though, it might be almost beneficial. You know, we're in an area which is quite dense woodland just now. You know, if they're churning up some of the soil, that might allow some seedlings to take root.
So there is certainly evidence that kind of disturbance on the field there in a dense forested situation like this might have a positive impact for a natural regenerating woodland. In our situation where we still concentrate quite heavily on producing commercial timber crops, we need to be very careful on what that impact is going to mean in those sort of areas. So we currently probably don't know enough about what that impact is on these restock sites. So our stance on them is just now is to keep controlling them at a sustained level so that in the future we're not dealing with an overrun population that's going to impact on our commercial timber.
And how are you able to monitor that? How can you get a handle on the numbers? Because I'm sure in this kind of environment they'd be difficult to count.
Yeah, absolutely. So this type of environment for us poses great challenges in census taking, specifically of feral wild pig. What we do is we monitor the number of deer in here quite regularly, so we just attach the pigs onto that as well. A lot of it is anecdotal evidence of members of the public seeing them, other forest workers seeing them, our contract staff seeing them, our own staff that are working in the forest seeing them, and also our wildlife staff seeing them on the ground. From there, we tend to then specifically pick areas of the forest that we know we can set up monitoring stations. So like we've discussed, the camera traps, the use of thermal imaging drones through a contractor and the use of our own thermal imaging equipment gives us a good idea of where pigs are and what sort of numbers they're coming into those areas. And what we don't know is how far they can travel in a night. It seems to range from anything up to about 7-8 miles in an evening. They're incredibly good swimmers, which poses other challenges, and it poses other challenges for neighbouring landowners as well.
And how do you know when you've got the number right?
I don't think we will know that for another few years. I think it's going to take quite a lot of data collection and quite a lot of collaborative working with Nature Scot and other landowners working almost like deer management groups in this situation. I think we need more dialogue between everyone to understand where healthy populations of pigs are, where control methods are taking an effect, and where some landowners might be looking at having pig populations under control but monitored because they've got the positive impacts that they want for their land management objectives. So a forum certainly needs to be in place. We certainly know there's four well-established populations down southwest, Dumfries and Galloway, here in Glenmoriston, Fort Augustus, and up in Tyrachalty, kind of west of Ross. From our own anecdotal knowledge and other speaking to other people, it certainly seems that there are small pockets of them flaring up here and there, pretty much all across the country, mostly where we don't see huge population centres. So, you know, the Central Belt, we don't see many instances of them popping up there. East Coast, and all the way up into the northwest, we're seeing more and more evidence of them appearing.
So they can't really just be left to their own devices, or they'll just continue to breed?
Yeah, so at the moment, we've discussed quite heavily in these events just now that we're dealing with a feral pig population that's quite heavily hybridised with domestic pigs. So at the moment, we need to understand that means that their ability to breed and their ability to produce more young than an actual wild boar that comes from Western Europe is a lot higher than what it should normally be. We're on average seeing about 4 to 6 piglets being born per sow. If we continue to let them hybridise and continue to let them mix with domestic animals, they can produce up to 13 to 18 young in one go, which poses us quite a lot of issues in the future if we don't continue to proactively control them in these situations.
It's Kieran Watson, Wildlife Ranger Manager with Forestry Land Scotland, and Morag Milne, who's a Wildlife Policy Officer for Nature Scot. Now, more information events like this are being held in the coming weeks and months, and you can keep an eye on them on social media. I think Nature Scot were really surprised at the level of interest in this. They put on social media that they were going to have an event, and it was just message after message saying, we need one of these, yeah. When are you going to have one of these? Yeah. So this is obviously a huge discussion area, and they are being controlled just now. You know, the numbers are being controlled, and that's being done through culling them. And of course, the meat can enter the food chain. A lot of people enjoy eating effectively wild boar.
Yeah, but do the dealers actually want it?
To some extent. Yeah. I suspect there's more of them out there than the dealers necessarily want.
It's easier said than done. I spoke to a keeper just south of Fort Augustus who spent 3 days stalking this boar.
Mm-hmm.
He says it was much, much harder to get the boar than it was to get a fox. And foxes are notoriously crafty.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, almost have a sixth sense when there's somebody about. You know, but he says the pig was it was like dealing with a human being.
Yeah, I can imagine. Have you seen one in the wild?
Never.
No, my husband did, actually. When he was out walking in the West Highlands, he encountered one. And of course, they are dangerous.
What are you supposed to do?
Well,
don't annoy it.
They are dangerous
animals. If it wants to watch that channel on the telly, let it.
That's pretty much it. Keep back. So if you do encounter one, the advice is, you know, don't approach it. For goodness sake, don't approach it. If you've got dogs, keep them on the leads. Try and stick to the paths, particularly during breeding seasons. And if you can, report them as well, because report your sightings, because Nature Scotland and Forestry Land Scotland want to build up a big picture of where they are.
Yeah, precisely. Anyway, the closing date for submissions for a third and possibly fourth National Park for Scotland was actually last Thursday. On Monday, I managed to catch up with Neil MacLeod, who's involved in the bid for the Loch Awe area.
We're walking along an ancient track, Bealacha Brainn, and Bealacha Brainn was the way to the Baron's house, the Baron being Baron McCorkadale from the 8th century.
It's a magnificent view because, you know, there's snow on probably the top 1,000 feet of Ben Cruachan. And below that, you know, you've got the hills, you've got Sitka Forestry, you've got farmland underneath that. I can see sheep, I can see cattle. If you get your way, this is going to become part of a national park. What will be the sort of boundaries of that national park? How big will it be?
The national park boundaries will start in the north at Glencoe and then take in the whole massif of Cruachan, and then reach down the Loch Awe to the ancient kingdom of Darida, which is down in the south end at Kilmartin. And then either side it would perhaps stretch out 25, 50 miles in width. It may even include Oban, as there's now discussion about bringing in the Oban area.
So what do you see a national park allowing you to do that you can't do just now?
OK, well, a national park, in my view, would create a bit of a pushback against the current gold rush development projects that are sort of taking place here. We're not against the idea of creating a green energy scenario, as it's clearly essential that we need to do something to offset the carbon that's being put out into the environment. But we are against sacrificing a most beautiful area with an incredible natural heritage unnecessarily to overdevelop it. That was the compromise here. We are quite proud of the fact that we are producing so much renewable energy already in this area.
So you can see being a national park allowing you to stop this gold rush, as you see. That allows you to stop something. What does it allow you to do?
We're looking to coexist in harmony, and we're looking for the developers of this green energy to also take a stop and respect the natural heritage that they may inadvertently be destroying. There needs to be a balance, and what I'm looking to achieve, and my colleagues and friends and supporters are looking to achieve, is to protect the natural heritage of this area. Many people have come here because it's so beautiful to live, and the local people that have lived here for many generations would be devastated if the area was developed beyond the way it looks now to become an industrialised landscape. It's getting close to that in some areas already. We need to have a pushback, and a national park would allow us to do that.
Have you got the community behind you?
I believe I have. I believe I have the community. I've had six meetings all across the community, and I've had some very strong support from many different people. I've had a lot of people worried about control. That national park, they have this image that there'll be a planning control or there'll be
another layer of bureaucracy.
That's the one, yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
You're unusual, though, because you're a farmer and you're keen in the idea of a national park. An awful lot of farmers are very against the idea of a national park for precisely the reason we've just specified. They see it as being possibly another source of rules and regulations.
Well, having worked with Snowdonia National Park, helping farmers, and particularly hill farmers who are clearly more stressed and have perhaps become even more stressed since that time when I worked with Snowdonia National Park, I very much believe that a national park can make a lot of policies that will be very beneficial to the farmers here. And to have assistance to be offered by a national park for these farmers. I mean, for example, in Loch Lomond, the National Park even fills out their grant application forms for the farmers to assist them, basically because they respect them and they want them to still be there in another 50 years' time. One of the policies that if we get this national park created and up and running is that we would like to create up to 100 new crofts, small 7-acre crofts. And the reasoning behind this is one of the key things is that I believe that the quality of life that can be gained from living in a small croft where you have your own animals, a bit of your land that you can work on, as well as obviously a full-time day job, but your quality of life would be massively increased. And I believe this is something that perhaps even a hybrid crofting policy could be worked here with the Crofting Commission, so that we could take some of the rank land that is, I know, up and down the area we have proposed. There's quite a bit of land that's come out of agriculture, but it's there, and it's there. We could purchase it or bring it back into life. There's a lot of worry about the management of tourism in this area because the infrastructure is strained by the poor quality of the roads. We have only two main roads that enter into this area from the Glasgow side. And when one is blocked through a landslide, at the rest and be thankful, and the other one has a blockage due to flooding or a car accident, then our area is inaccessible. So there needs to be a force that supports a better evening out of the flow of tourism in the area. And I think the National Park, I know the National Park will do this because I worked for one before. That was exactly one of their policies. And I understand Loch Lomond National Park, who would be our neighbours, are already trying to work on this redistribution of tourism in a more balanced manner.
From your experience years ago, Snowdonia.
Yes.
You know, say there's a line between us at the moment. You're standing in the national park side. I'm standing out with the national park boundary. Is your life better than my life necessarily?
Yes. Yes, I think it might be. Because the policies of the national park would be beneficial to the person standing within the line of the national park. You would know that they've got your back.
Neil McLeod there from the bid for the Loch Awe area. Coming up later, we'll hear what the next steps are now when the bids are in. And, you know, if you have any views on that, you can give us a call. You know the number. Or you can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Coming up, what state are our rivers really in?
And, of course, we've got a mystery sound for you today. Let's have a listen.
I think it's reasonably straightforward.
Yeah, I think it's not too bad either. We've had some wrong guesses already.
Absolutely. David John Chadwick and Carl Luke says, I think it's mystery sound is a bird lost over water, but adds, particularly enjoyed the segment last week on the Discovery. Your mention of whales reminding me of Russian and Japanese whalers I saw in the Atlantic over 50 years ago. Only now is the world becoming aware how essential whales and other species are to a healthy ecosystem.
Denise and Phil say it's a similarly dree start to the day here in Rothes. Is today's mystery sound our resident robin wanting its breakfast? Reggie the Labrador has returned to his owner after a five-week holiday with us, so no 5 a.m. walk today, thankfully. We will, however, be going for our Saturday paddle in the Cold River Spey. Gets the blood flowing.
Oh, blimey. Craig Wilson in Cardonnell says today's sound is a woodpecker calling. Great start to the weekend. Will you be doing anything soon from Glencoe? You've not been there in a while. I don't know. It's a good suggestion, though, Craig.
Yeah, sounds nice. If you've got any idea what the sound is, get in touch. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is our email address. Text us 80295 or you can give us a call. You know the number, Mark.
Don't do that to me. 08 085 92 95 00.
Okay. Now, over the winter, the Cairngorm reindeer have been busy shedding their antlers. You'd probably think that those who look after the large herd end up with more of the distinctive bone than they know what to do with. But the opposite is actually true. Hen Robinson is one of the herders.
Although we've got sort of around about 150 reindeer in the herd, you'd think that would equal 300 antlers, which technically it pretty much will do. But the main thing about our herd is that they are free-ranging on the mountains for much of the year. The majority of them free-range in the winter months, and that is when the antlers are lost. So it's like looking for a needle in a haystack.
Yeah, it's a huge area, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a huge, big area. So, and if you've got a little antler and it's falling off into deep heather, I could walk 5 foot away from it and still not find it. So yes, unfortunately, don't get as many antlers as we'd like.
Do you actually go out in search of them?
We don't tend to actually go searching for them directly because, like I say, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. But if we see one fall off, or if we know one has literally just come off recently off a particular reindeer, and we know where that reindeer has been recently, then we'll go and have a wee scout around. But we don't spend too much effort looking for them.
When I imagine antlers, I think they're going to be tall and grand and pointy. But of course, they don't all necessarily look like that, do they?
Antlers can be sort of all shapes and sizes, really. They can be the biggest ratio of antler to body size amongst the deer species. So reindeer aren't a big animal. They're only about a metre tall at the shoulder at the most, really. So they can have huge antlers for that body size, but they're perhaps not maybe always as big as people expect. A female reindeer tend to grow smaller, thinner, lighter antlers. They don't weigh as... It's the males that grow the really big ones.
Mm-hmm. And it all depends on whether they've been castrated as well. That seems to have a big impact on it.
Yeah, so we castrate most of our male reindeer when they reach about 3 years old. It can help us control the breeding and make sure we don't risk inbreeding. When you castrate an animal, it changes the hormone balance, and antler growth is all controlled by hormones. So castrating a reindeer means that it sort of checks the antler growth slightly. The antlers don't tend to be quite as big in the future. They'll still get good size, but not as big. Crucially for us is that the effect it does have is that the bone of the antler doesn't harden quite as much. So for the castrated male reindeer, they will often tend to break their antlers off in pieces, you don't get a nice, clean, big set of antlers from them. You'll get sort of broken pieces of antler from them, so not as nice. So.
Yeah, and what can you do with that, if anything?
The antlers from the castrated males, because the bone isn't as hard, you can't really do very much with them. They're decorational, you can pop them up on your wall, but they're not so much use for anything as such. Antlers from an entire male or female, it's solid bone, it's really strong. I mean, mainly people want them for decoration, want to stick a pair of antlers on a wall. But here in the reindeer centre, lots of our shelves are held up with antlers, in brackets made of antlers. There's a big set of antlers from the 50s that are above the Raven in reindeer house, which is very useful for drying wet clothing. Many pairs of soggy wellies have been upside down on those antlers over the years, and they can be crafted as well. So my manager Fiona makes antler jewellery from occasionally knife handles and things like that as well, but often slices the antler up into small pieces and sells in our shop here at the Reindeer Centre, and on our website, sort of for necklaces and earrings and things like that. Yeah.
Do they all produce antlers?
The vast majority of reindeer produce antlers. They're interesting because it's the only species where male and female grow antlers. For most other deer species, it's just the male. So for reindeer, it's females as well. Very occasionally, you get a reindeer, usually a female, either doesn't grow any or just grows one. So we've got currently one reindeer in the herd, a three-year-old called Juniper, and she doesn't grow any. And we have one reindeer currently, another, again, a female, who only grows one, same age, three-year-old. Her name's Holy Moly.
Because you know the herd so well, you will know the antlers that you could potentially get your hands on. You must look forward to that if you can find them.
We keep a photographic record of every single reindeer in the herd every year. So even if we find an antler that's years old, we can often identify which individual reindeer it came from. But yes, I love coming across an antler on the ground or seeing one fall off a reindeer and, oh, there's something to sell.
You've got some in your shop. Shall we have a look?
We can indeed, yeah.
Just me!
Have you got a particular favourite?
So my favourite set of antlers in here is probably the big set in the window just here. So all these antlers on the end wall here are from a reindeer called Cran. And Cran holds the record for growing the biggest set of antlers we've ever had in our herd, which were grown in 2011, and they weighed 8.9 kilograms when they fell off. We've got his antlers from, 2007, 8, 2009, 2010 here in the shop. So his biggest set is 2011 set. I aren't actually here, but mainly because our shop is very small and there's no space left to display those ones. So, but probably this 2009 set here are in the window are probably my favourites. They're a beautiful set.
They're so pointy as well. You're actually able to hang things from them on display here.
Yeah, they're great. I mean, it saves putting hooks up to hang decorations on to sell. They're very, very useful. So,
obviously had the decency to leave them somewhere where you could find them.
Yeah, for a reindeer like Cran, because he grew these enormous, big, beautiful antlers, at the point where he was due to drop them, which would be around about December each year, we generally tried to make sure he was in an area that when he dropped them, we would find them. Because we have all his antlers from various years, we don't want to lose them. We would never, ever sell his antlers because they hold such nostalgic value because he's the record holder, as it were. We wanted to get our hands on them.
Ian Robinson there.
Yeah, and a Cairngorm Reindeer Run and Adoption Scheme And those who choose to adopt a reindeer get first dibs on buying the antlers.
Oh, that's clever.
It's very clever, yeah. So anything that's left is sometimes turned into craft projects or whatever and then sold in the shop. But be warned, it's in short supply.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember where I was recently. And it was, I was talking to a keeper. And it's not reindeer antlers, but red deer antlers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, shed was just full of it. I said, is this off animals that, you know, you've culled? He says, no, says most of this was just found on the hill.
Yeah, it was just found. I love with this that they can find an antler that was probably dropped, I know, years and years before. And because they take photographs of all the antlers, they go, oh, that belongs to such and such. I think it's amazing they can do that. Because often the pieces are quite small, you know?
Did you? When reindeer move, they have a tendon in their back legs that clicks.
Okay.
And it's supposedly to allow, when they're moving through blizzards and things like that, they can stay in contact. They can follow each other.
Oh, that's very clever.
That could have been a good mystery sound.
Well, it could have been. Sorry, I didn't get that. I'll get it next time.
Coming up, we've got the long-awaited restoration of an Art Deco pavilion up here in the northeast of Scotland. And a really nice project which is intended to bring, you know, dead ash trees back to life, in a manner of speaking.
Yeah, it's a nice project, that. And, of course, we also have a mystery sound. Let's have a listen.
Nice one, nice one. Now, there are some incorrect guesses here, so you start them.
Okay. Fiona says, good morning, Out of Doors team. Always enjoy listening to your podcast on a Saturday with a pot of tea. I think the mystery sound is a great spotted woodpecker making its call in flight. Last weekend, I sighted a red kite near my home in the Scottish Borders. Great to see, as this is the first one seen in this part of the region that I know of. That's lovely.
Winnie, from a little village near the still snow-covered Bavarian mountains, says, my son Peter thinks the mystery sound is a parrot or a woodpecker. I disagree and guess it's a blue tit. She says, I once worked on a fruit farm near Perth, picking all kinds of fruit. Your programme reminds me of my many trips to Scotland. Please keep it up.
Oh, Ross and Tainalt says, is the mystery sound a little greep?
And Alistair and Elgin says, how are we going to get this into a wrinkly red tin roof? I don't know. Says, dreek is certainly the word of the day. Fingers crossed it improves my trip to Inverurie, where the locos entertain the coasters.
Who are the coasters?
I don't know.
Oh.
Inverurie locals are a football team, however.
Yes. Do you know that?
That's where you live. I haven't a scooby about today's mystery sound, says Alistair. Best I can come up with is the Lesser Haggis Warbler's distress call, having just spotted a feral pig. If there was a feral pig about, the Lesser Haggis would be gone. Keep up the good work.
Very good guesses. You've still got plenty of time to get your guess in. Get in touch. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us on 80295, or you can give us a ring on 0805 92 95 00. Mark is in a mischievous mood. He decided to cover up the phone number, so I was trying to read it out just to see if I could recall it. But you could.
Don't do it to me, please. We're going to be turning our attention now to the health of our rivers, as the latest State of Rivers report is about to be published. It's not a pretty picture, has to be said, but one river seems to be bucking the trend, according to the map published as part of this report from the Rivers Trust.
Yeah, it's the River Findhorn, and it's classified as in a good ecological state, unlike the majority of the rivers on the east coast of Scotland, which are deemed as poor or bad.
Now, why should this be? Well, recently I went to the Findhorn near Forest to find out about the work that the Findhorn Watershed Initiative has been doing to improve the health of the river. I spoke with Bob Lawton of the Findhorn Nairn and Lossie Rivers Trust and with Elle Adam of the Watershed Initiative, who together outlined some of the issues involved in this kind of river management.
I guess the project we started here on the Findhorn Watershed Initiative, is sort of born out of that intention to help all sorts of different land managers, landowners, all the different stakeholders that are involved in and care about the rivers, kind of come together to work in a more coordinated and collaborative way. And whilst absolutely people have different worldviews and different experiences and kind of see land management opportunities in a different way, I guess what we're trying to do is help everyone see themselves as one part in a puzzle that everyone needs to work together to make the rivers as healthy as possible and supportive for wildlife, but also in terms of climate mitigation responsibility, making sure that we're storing carbon, that kind of thing, in our river ecosystems.
Is it always necessarily a happy result?
I'm not sure humans are great at doing that all the time, but we've definitely had positive interactions and feedback so far from a range of different parties. And I think, you know, we're also pragmatic. We're not setting out to do some complete overhaul of all the landscapes around. You know, we want to create a mosaic of nature-rich habitats along our rivers, and we need everyone to play their role in that, the farmers, the land managers, the keepers and the landowners. And so it's definitely within our interest to help everyone get along.
This has really sprung from a conversation I had with Martin Kennedy of the NFUS, who was bemoaning the fact that farmers nowadays are practically allowed to do nothing in rivers. They can't do this, they can't do that, they can't dredge. They, you know, they're constantly being told what they can't do, and they're very worried about the fact that rivers are going to burst their banks and flood and damage productive ground. What's your position on that, Bob?
Our position is that rivers are living entities in their own right, and certainly in this area, but in most of Scotland, they are important spawning areas for salmon and trout. And just simply to go and extract gravel would do significant damage to the populations of fish, salmon and trout primarily, but other fish species as well. So it needs to be considered in a much more rational manner. It's not to say there's not some opportunities for management of rivers as they might expect, but what I think we need to remember is that that's the production area for us as fisheries interests. It's just the same as the fields, the production area for a farmer.
Are there ever circumstances where dredging, to your mind, is permissible, acceptable?
Well, we try and look at everything on a case-by-case basis. Recently, we had a case, for instance, on one of our local burns where the riverbed had become considerably higher than the surrounding land. And although there was fish interest...
How does that happen?
It's from deposition from upstream, and it had built up over a period of about 20 to 30 years. It had been maintained prior to that, but maintenance had stopped for, well, at least 30 years, we think. So in that case, we assessed it, checked it out for fish. There were fish populations there. We do some fish rescues to transfer the fish elsewhere, and then provided SEPA provide a CAR licence, which is a controlled activities regulations, the work can go ahead. And we work with that farmer to be sympathetic to the removal of the gravel, but also to reinstate banks in a more ecological manner, using some green engineering in that particular instance.
When people reference farming, they talk about people working the land. That's precisely what they do. They're accustomed to taking the land as a resource and shaping it to their own ends and doing what needs to be done to produce a product. You can understand how they could look at a river in exactly the same way.
Yes, for sure, and in some respects we look at a river in that way, in that that is where our fish are produced. And with salmon particularly being recently reclassed as endangered, it's all the more important that we look after rivers properly and manage them properly such that we get fish coming back for future generations. And that's going to be quite a tough call in the next few years. You know, salmon numbers are not maybe an all-time low, but they're very, very low at the moment. So we need to make sure we protect them as we can. And therefore it's important to work alongside farmers, landowners, to ensure that we keep a natural river in place and a natural bed as much as we can, but also manage it if it gets out of kilter. And there is a flooding issue, for instance, as well, then some action does need to be taken in that instance.
We're about 18 months into this project, and we started at the source and worked our way downstream. So we spent the most...
Literally at the source.
At the source, yeah, in the headwaters up around Tomatin. And we've been working with the estates up there, looking at opportunities for creating riparian woodland, so planting more trees along the rivers, but also getting in discussions about things like peatland restoration. But one of the interesting things that we're now starting to bring downstream more is the priority around deer management. It's a kind of something that you maybe wouldn't expect a rivers trust to have a real interest in, but what we've realised is that deer have such a strong impact when there are too many of them in terms of stopping the woodland naturally regenerating along our rivers. So that's something that has been a really interesting sort of subject to bridge between different parties that have the responsibility of managing the land, and helping everyone work together at a catchment scale to manage the deer has been something that we've been focusing on.
You know, and I think we often forget this, that a river needs space to move. It won't stay in the same spot for year on year. It'll shift after big spates and it'll shift over time. So you need to create areas so that that can happen. And certainly some financial incentive to do so would be very, very welcome. I'm not that au fait with all the things that are available to farmers, so I wouldn't comment too much on it, but certainly a push in that direction would be very, very welcome.
Bob Lawton and Elle Adam of the Findhorn Watershed Initiative there. You know, Bob mentioned low salmon numbers. Scottish Government published provisional catch statistics this week, which show that 2023 yielded the lowest catch for wild salmon on record. It was a 25% drop in the previous year.
Yeah, that'll be really disappointing news. All of this would imply that this is all inextricably linked to the health of our rivers in general, something that's been thrown into the spotlight this week with the publication of the State of Rivers report by the Rivers Trust. UK-wide, things are not looking good. So joining us now is Tessa Wardley of the Trust. Firstly, Tessa, can you give us an overview of the picture across the whole of the UK?
Hi, yes. Nice to be with you. Hi. Yeah, the data is not great. So the rivers, the State of Our Rivers report really brings together all the data that we have into one place in an easily accessible and findable and readable format. And yeah, in England and Northern Ireland, no single stretch of river is in good overall health. Picture is slightly better in Wales and Scotland, but it's still, you know, extremely worrying. So in Scotland, 57% of rivers are in good or better health. But you know, that's still not a great picture, and you can really see, looking at the map, the overriding impact in areas of densest population and most intensive agriculture.
What criteria do you use when you say a river's good or bad?
So to assess good ecological status, they look at a number of different factors. So they look at the chemical status of the river. So that looks at things like nutrients, the oxygen levels, temperature, the actual sort of characteristics of the water. Then they also look at the bugs and beasts that live in the river. So the macroinvertebrates, they're known as technically, and they're the kind of the bottom of the food chain. They're very reactive to what's happening in the river. So they're a good indication of how healthy a river is. You also look at the physical condition of the river. So previous people were talking about the state of the gravels and things like that. So that looks at, riverbed, the river banks, the shape of the river, and all of those things are kind of compared to what you would hope to find in the river if it was in a good condition, and that gives you your overall status.
So what's causing this then? Why are they in such a bad state?
Well, it's, you know, years and years and decades of abuse pretty much. So in terms of water quality, they're being plagued by sewage, chemical, nutrient and plastic pollution. And as I said, we've also heavily modified our rivers for human needs. So dredging, straightening, deepening, widening, putting in barriers. And all of these things have a big impact. And some of the biggest impacts are coming from the way we manage our land. So agriculture and land use, our urbanisation, so cities and roads where water rushes off collecting pollutants on the way, and our water industry, certainly in England, has been poorly managed and mismanaged over the recent decades, and that's been causing a problem.
Has anybody looked at the significance of the fact that the control of water is usually no longer held by that country? What impact does that have? I mean, if you the whole idea of the polluter pays, if you don't actually live in the country where the pollution's happening, why would you care?
Well, yeah, and that's one of the big factors that people often bring up. I mean, it's hard to say, we don't have a counter argument where the country owns the rights. I mean, in fact, we do. I mean, in Scotland and Wales, it's much more locally owned, and, you know, actually that hasn't necessarily been proved a better system. So it's hard to say whether that's, you know, the biggest impact. I think it's more generally just about the regulation and enforcement of those industries necessarily than where the ownership is. But, you know, yeah, it does make you feel that if the ownership is outside the country, that they probably have a lesser stake in what's happening.
The picture in Scotland, as you say, is a bit better than in England. Is it an improving situation? Does it keep getting better? Is that what you're seeing?
Well, I don't know a lot about the trends in Scotland so much, but certainly in England and actually Europe-wide, we're finding that the quality of our rivers has stagnated. So we tend to think of, you know, that it's been a there has been historically much worse pollution when we were a more industrial country, and there was even less control over our sewage, and there were improvements up until sort of the 70s, 1970s, post, you know, as industrialisation reduced, things did improve, and our river quality and pollution in particular did decrease. We're now finding that that has stagnated, and there are a number of reasons for that, and that might be partly, you know, investment into water industry and the like, but also our increasing population and urbanisation, and the fact that we haven't really been reversing some of the physical modifications on our rivers. And that can be a particular problem in Scotland, I think. You know, the man-made barriers, modification to physical conditions, water use for hydropower and things like that are some of the main reasons that Scottish rivers will be having a problem.
Is this fixable?
Yes, it is, yeah. And people from Findhorn who are talking there, you know, they're really putting in place and delivering the way we should be working, you know, that kind of working together, bringing all the different parties together. You know, we really can't solve this by looking at one problem at a time. So even if we, you know, cleaned up all the sewage inputs and, you know, resolved all of that, we'd still find that a lot of the rivers would be failing because land use and physical habitat are not right. So we really have to make sure that all parties are working together and that all the stakeholders are involved in this, because our rivers, you know, you talk about, you mentioned that, you know, they're a resource. They are a resource. They're a resource for nature as well as people. A well-functioning, healthy river actually helps us to combat climate change and is protecting our land. You know, we really can't have one without the other. Our rivers are essential in combating the increasingly extreme weather conditions that we're facing. So healthy rivers will help us combat drought. They'll help us combat flooding. And, you know, these are all sort of really fundamental to our future thriving communities.
There has been such a big rise in popularity of wild swimming, as we all know. Is there anything that we should be looking out for before we dive in? Because this is a concern if you like to swim in rivers.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm a very keen open water swimmer, so, you know, it's something very close to my heart. Yeah, and I think as open water swimmers, we are always aware of the risks. You know, there is inherent risk in swimming in wild waters. So, you know, when you go to the river, you are always looking at, you know, where you can get in safely, where you can get out safely. Is it too cold? You know, do you have the right equipment to warm you up quickly afterwards? Is the water flow too fast? You know, are you going to scrape your knees on the gravel bed or, you know, things in the water? You know, so we are always weighing up those risks. And I think we just have to think of the state of the river and the state of the water, condition of the water, as another of those risks to weigh up. So, you know, we publish a sewage map, which shows you where all the combined sewer overflows are. So that's something, you know, you might want to look at before you're jumping in a river, is look at where discharges are of sewage. If there's been very high rainfall, they might be discharging untreated sewage. So, you know, and post-rainfall, you're going to get a lot more runoff from roads, as well as from livestock and farmland. And that's, you know, you just need to weigh those kind of things up as part of your sort of natural risk assessment before you get in the water.
Things to be aware of. Tessa, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
No problem. It's lovely to talk to you.
And nice to talk to you too. Thank you very much. That was Tessa Wardley of the Rivers Trust there. Now, until a few years ago, there was only one bird of prey which was resident on Shetland, the Merlin, or Peary Hawk as they call it locally. But now there's a new kid in the block, the Sparrowhawk. And since arriving in 2018, it's said they've been rapidly colonising the islands.
Yeah, so the Zetland Raptor Study Group has been colour-ringing every new sparrowhawk chick successfully fledged in Shetland in the hope of understanding their movements. And it seems the arrival of the sparrowhawk isn't the only change in the island's ecology. Hugh Williams from BBC Radio Shetland has been hearing more from Logan Johnson of the group.
When they first came to Shetland, we never really had much of a reason to go into the trees. Usually all we found was the plantations were very dense and all you had really was hooded crows and goldcrests. But remember the public came across to us and showed us that they'd found a newly fledged group of chicks up north. And in the following year, there was a big invasion of two-barred crossbills into Shetland, the biggest in British history. So everyone was looking in these plantations, finding these newly fledged sparrowhawks. That year and the following year, we had a good look through all the plantation and couldn't find any evidence of nests. And nests can retain for a number of years. But there wasn't really much evidence, you know, birds display, they make a lot of racket, the young, so people were likely to come across them.
And you now know that they are definitely here, sparrowhawks resident here, just not just migratory passing through.
No, not just migratory. We've never had birds summering, really, before maybe 2016. But now we're seeing summering birds everywhere. People are seeing them in their gardens. They've been seen taking birds off bird feeders. We've now got, as of 2023, 19 breeding pairs in Shetland, which is just slowly increasing every year.
It's pretty dense woodland, some of this, now we've left that clearing, eh? Yeah. But I guess if they have been here, we might even see traces of their nests.
Yep.
What were we looking out for?
Well, when you're looking out for nests, you're looking for any kind of clump of sticks to get in a tree, maybe no more than 2 foot across. Very much like a hooded crow nest.
I mean, what are the chances that we'll see evidence of that today? But will we go and have a look?
Yep, we'll have a pretty further look. See what we can get.
And if you wanted evidence that they are indeed here and are taking food, just describe what's at our feet here.
Yeah, so, well, I've just stepped in myself. You know, you're walking through a woodland, if you find a small pile of feathers, you know, spread over an area, sometimes it looks like they've been almost plucked out of a bird. That's an obvious sign of a sparrowhawk. They like to pluck their food before they carry it off and eat it somewhere.
So what was this before it was dispatched by a sparrowhawk?
Well, obviously we're missing the body, but looking at kind of the barry and kind of orangey russet barry, and it looks like a sniper, I'd say, or a woodcock. But more likely a snipek, I would say.
Then, just a few minutes later.
Yeah, that is a very... Oh, I think that's a sparrowhawk nest. It's got some very, very straight twigs on it. So maybe it's worth getting up and having a look.
Can we get through these branches? So your suspicion would be the what? That that's an old crow's nest that then has been reused by a sparrowhawk?
No, this is a completely sparrowhawk.
It's been built as a sparrowhawk nest.
If you look at the twigs, they're very straight, whereas hooded crows are usually quite a messy bottom, and I'm pretty certain that, that could be a sparrowhawk. And also, if you look at your feet as well, there's another old... That's an older sparrowhawk kill. Could be months old, that one.
So more feathers, not nearly such a dense number, but...
No, so that obviously means it's been sitting much longer.
I mean, there's at least half a dozen, 8, 9, 10. In fact, more, the more you look, the more you see.
Yeah, it's amazing. Once you get your eye into these plantations, how much more you tend to find.
For the past 2 years, members of the Zetland Raptor Study Group have been colour-ringing chicks hatched in Shetland, 62 so far. 14 of those birds have subsequently been recorded, with the sightings starting to build up a picture of their movements.
These chicks have generally been found to just move within Shetland, and they seem to be slowly setting up possible wintering territories. We've had one bird down the South Mainland. For the last 2 winters, it's been seen there. And it's the first time we've had a bird in 2 years, you know, 2 different breeding seasons being seen, which is quite good. But it's not just Shetland they're being seen in. We had one bird from Barrister up at Glus, went all the way down and was found dead on a beach near Inverness, which is the first record of a Shetland hatched bird ever being out with the Isle.
That slightly raises the question of where the first resident ones would have come from if they're capable of ranging such distances.
And there's much debate even within the Raptor Study Group of where the Shetland birds are coming from. Some of us think they're Scandinavian, others seem to think they're British given the increase in the British population. But we haven't done any genetic studies yet. So
that is that the kind of thing you could tell by DNA?
Yeah, I mean, in Britain alone, anyway, the ones in southern England are smaller than the ones in northern Scotland. So the Shetland birds would be kind of hard to tell because they'd probably be similar in size to both northern Scotland and Norway, Scandinavia. But you could easily tell from genetic study of northern Scottish birds and probably Scandinavian birds.
People will tell you that they hear a lot more owls in Shetland now than... you ever used to. Is this a sign that the ecology here is really changing pretty dramatically, and what could the impacts of that potentially be if that's right?
Well, yeah, no, we're seeing both increases of long-eared and short-eared owls. Long-eared owls haven't really established themselves again as a proper breeder, but the problem is they're so horrifically secretive, it's really hard to nail them sometimes. But short-eared owls have definitely increased as well. They first began breeding the same year Sparrowhawk in 2018, and the last 2 years we've had about four or five successful breeding pairs, which no one would have believed before, because we have no voles in Shetland. So they must be feeding on small birds, mice, and amphibians. But yes, the whole ecology of Shetland is changing. Obviously, you know, persecution of birds of prey is decreasing, thankfully, across Britain. It's nothing like it used to be. Poison events are rare, and, you know, birds are generally doing much better with reintroduction programs. So hopefully, Shetland's going to become very similar to Orkney and also mainland Britain. White-tailed eagle are probably set to come back in the next 10 to 20 years. Possibly buzzard could colonise, given the big increase in Orkney and the big local records increase. And even possibly hen harrier, which has shown to colonise Lewis and the Upper Hebrides the last 15 years. So
it sounds to me like you're describing an ecosystem that's getting more and more top-heavy with predators, and they will all be competing for the same, presumably inevitably diminishing, prey species. And that will have its effect in the long run. There may well be a crash then of some of these big rises.
There could be, but usually with a lot of these species, they all have their own niche. So white-tailed eagles, for example, and buzzard, they're very lazy, and a lot of their diet has been found to be carrion or fish or wild food. White-tailed eagle especially, a new study's come out from the west coast of Scotland for the last 40 years showing that they'll virtually only target wild food, you know, fish, and in other areas they'll eat lots of carrion of rabbits and go for, you know, red grouse in the hills where there's not the availability. The more predators you get as well, they might start eating the other peary predators. So, you know, buzzards might start driving out sparrowhawks from nests, and white-tailed eagles might eat the buzzards, and they'll eat lots of ravens as well. So the balance will be coming back. You know, you need that ecosystems with top-level predators that eat the smaller-level predators and then eat the peary predators, or else you just have a population that kind of runs amok.
Ben Johnson there from the Zetland Raptor Study Group. And if you spot a sparrowhawk up there wearing one of their red colour rings with white letter codes on his left leg, Logan at the Zetland Raptor Study Group would be very keen to hear from you. I had actually quite a close encounter with a sparrowhawk just the other day.
Did you?
I came out of the house and out, coming around the top and down the drive, and I heard this real racket behind me, what have you. I mean, a distress call from a blackbird. And I looked around to see if I could see what it was, because I thought it was probably the cat or something like that. And this sparrowhawk came barreling round the corner, you know, about 6 feet off the ground, with a blackbird in its talons. Ooh. You know, and the blackbird was the one that was making all the fuss, yeah, understandably, uh-huh, because it was not looking good for the blackbird. The sparrowhawk nearly flew into me, hung a left, smacked straight into the big room window, mm-hmm, dropped the blackbird, it flew off one way, and the sparrowhawk flew off the other.
Oh, brilliant.
So I did a good thing, accidentally.
Right? Yeah, well, I thought last year that big pile of feathers in my garden might have been the work of a sparrowhawk, but you just told me it was a cat.
No, probably wasn't.
It's a rain in my parade.
Yeah, exactly. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. Sitting next to me here at Beech Grove is Rachel Stewart. If you miss any of this, I'm doing ways of listening again.
Yeah, one of the best ways is by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, also available from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listen. That's what our regular correspondent in Kentucky, Greg Davis, did. He said, good morning, Mark and Rachel. This is a first. For the first time, Out of Doors made me salivate. Surely not. It's also almost springtime here in Kentucky. Time to get the tatties, or as we call them here, taters, into the ground. And oh my, is there anything more delightful than, as Mark so eloquently described, taters slathered in butter with some chopped scallions on top. Pure gustatory delight.
Yeah, very nice. Very nice. What a lovely email. Do get in touch with us then if you want to send us your views on what you're listening to.
Yeah.
That was Greg there from Lexington in Kentucky. Time for our mystery sound again. Let's have a listen. Loads and loads of guesses. Heather from Linlithgow says, is it a moorhen? No.
Gordon and Maureen in Ethybridge thought it might be a chiff-chaff.
Yeah, Sandy feed on Lugus. A kestrel or similar bird of prey?
Good guess there, Sandy. And Alan Marks thinks it might be a moorhen. If not, I'll make an appointment with an audiologist to have my lugs examined.
Stevie on the Digger in Edinburgh says, is it the squeaky wheel on Paddy's wheelbarrow on a Friday at Lousing Time? Great show as always.
Geography Carolyn Torfins thought it might be a greater spotted woodpecker. We heard one earlier.
Yeah. Muckety Scouse, I think the mystery sound is a wren warning call.
Coasters, a Lossiemouth FC, apparently, according to Jock Woods and a Dreich Lossie. And he thinks it's a wren. No, he thinks it's a vole calling a warning. That's what it is.
Lindsay thinks it's a peregrine falcon. All wrong, but do get in touch if you want to have a guess. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295 or give us a ring 0885 92 95 00.
Earlier on we heard about the bid from the Lochoy area to become a contender for Scotland's next national park. Now the closing day for all submissions was last Thursday, but there's still a long process to go through before any decisions will be made. One thing I've always been aware of is that national parks, other parts of the world, America for example, are run by the country or the state they're in. They own the land, and we don't have that model here. That's something I put to Nikki Sinclair from the Scottish National Park Strategy Project.
National parks really have very little teeth to... It's all about carrots, not sticks, for how they conduct their business and try and achieve the aims of national parks. So it's all done by persuasion, really, or by bringing extra funding in. We have four aims for national parks in Scotland. So there's the socio-economic, communities are in the aims.
And the other three aims?
To enhance the natural and cultural heritage. There's one about enjoyment and recreation for the public, and the sustainable management of the natural resources of the areas.
Bids are in. What's the next stage?
There's an appraisal process of all the bids going on. That's being conducted by the Scottish Government. So they're going to be looking at things like the national importance of the natural heritage and the cultural heritage of the areas, the size, coherence, the special qualities of the area, and really how they fit with the requirements of the National Parks of Scotland Act.
We've spoken to the vast majority of bids, you know, that have gone in the groups, sometimes it was individuals. It struck me how important it was to actually frame the geography accurately. What I wanted in my head was to have a clear identity of where this was. Presumably that's going to be pretty crucial.
Yes, and after that assessment of the criteria has happened, there's still some flexibility about boundaries, and the next process after the recommendation is made to ministers, and ministers can propose an area as a potential national park or more than one. And then there's the statutory reporting phase, which is a process set out in the National Parks Act. And the report is going to be NatureScot, we believe, and they will conduct a much more rigorous consultation process and background research and look at the criteria all over again, and a very detailed consideration of the boundaries.
So it is possible that ministers would look at a particular bid and say, yeah, we like that, but we need it to be slightly bigger, or we need it to be slightly smaller, or can you shift it slightly one way or another?
Potentially, yeah, but there would be public consultation on that.
So there's wiggle room.
There's wiggle room, and they would have to set out their reasons for doing that, so hopefully that will all be in the public domain if that happens.
And is the management structure for any new national park, whether it's one or two or however many, likely to follow the same management structures as exist for Loch Lomond and the Trossachs and the Cairngorms? Or have times changed?
There's certainly flexibility in the legislation for different models. And, it would seem that if you have more national parks, you might want to share some of the functions of the national park. So you might not need to replicate the whole of the National Park Authority. But that might depend on geography, where the national park is, and requirements of it.
I'm not going to ask you about what do you think the hot favourites are, but I'm curious, do you see it as being one national park or more? What's your instinct? More than one national park?
Oh, it would be really positive if it was more than one, but I don't know whether that's going to be possible for various resource reasons. But I would really like it if this process was built on, and even, you know, bids that aren't successful this time, if there could be a bit more ambition to have more national parks in the future, if there's an appetite for it, or even where national park doesn't seem to be the right solution. There do seem to be lots of positive aspirations coming out of the process. I mean, I know there's lots of discussions going on, but people do have ideas of how their local area could be improved and managed for the better. And I really hope they're taken forward in some other form, if not a national park.
Have we got a time frame as to when we might actually get a decision?
Yes, roughly. So the proposals and then the reporting stage should happen in the summer. So the reporting stage starts. That might take 9 months a year, maybe. So we'll be looking at maybe summer 2025. And then there's a designation order to be taken through the Scottish Parliament. So that will be scrutinised and consulted on. There'll be a public consultation on that as well. So if it goes through the Parliament, it will be operational and come into effect possibly late 2025, early 2026.
I like the idea of using persuasion, of discussing and things like that, and it being more carrot than stick. But there must be occasions where having a dirty great big stick would be really useful.
Well, some of the you know, critics of our national parks would definitely like to see more of a stick, you know, for national parks to have more powers. You know, there's concerns over natural heritage. The government's got targets for 30 by 30 and biodiversity. And, you know, we are in a biodiversity crisis. We're in a climate crisis. So quite rightly, the national parks are expected to deliver on that. I'm sure not everybody is going to be convinced that this is the way forward, and the process has obviously thrown up quite a lot of concerns. It's a pretty innovative way of doing it. I'm not aware of this sort of bottom-up approach being done elsewhere. I mean, England have just announced they're going to have a national park, and they're going to choose between a couple of areas. Wales are consulting about a new national park, but that's just one area being considered. So on the face of it, it seems like quite a positive thing that it's an open nominations system, but it's certainly got discussions happening.
Maybe we just like to argue here in Scotland.
maybe.
Nikki Sinclair of the Scottish National Parks Strategy Project.
Yeah, just to remind you, the areas submitting bids are the Scottish Borders, Galloway, Lochaber, Lochaw and Tay Forest. Quite a few of the other areas have dropped out.
Indeed. Now, we heads up about a fascinating programme on BBC Radio 4 this evening. If you spend any time on or in the water, it is very likely you will have already noticed that the RNLI is celebrating a massive milestone on Monday next week. It's bicentenary. 200 years of volunteers saving lives around the coast of the UK and Ireland.
In tonight's Archive on 4, RNLI at 200, sailor and long-standing RNLI supporter Griffiths Jones dives into the history of the institution, where he draws on stories from the recent RNLI 200 Voices project. And you can hear more on that tonight then on Archive on 4. It's been produced by Penny Lutton Stewart and Dan Holland, a former RNLI volunteer himself.
Well worth a listen.
Absolutely. Now, work is well underway to restore the Art Deco Pavilion building at the outdoor Tarlier swimming pool in the northeast. Plans to save the disused Lido near Macduff have been the subject of much discussion for several years, I think, as many of us know. And it's hoped that in the longer term, the full site can be brought back into use. Later this year, the pavilion will open to the public as a cafe, heritage space, workshop, community space, etc. Pat Wayne from Friends of Tarlier and Vincent Willix from the construction company carrying out the restoration showed me round.
The roof will be left as it had been originally left, Ken, but we've had some additional strengthening to put in just due to the age of the building and some decay with the steel going on the edge of the beams. But everything else, the windows look like what they were originally, and then the internal finish will be back to paneling on the walls. Etc., which it looked like when it was originally built.
Has this been a big job?
Yes, it is. As I say, we've been in business for over 35 years, and we do specialise a bit in the heritage, and we're a contractor that does that kind of work. So there's been hidden things we've found, haven't we, Pat, as well, which sometimes shocks a client but doesn't shock a contractor, because you do find if you're working in old buildings, you will get surprises.
What have you heard here then that surprised you?
Surprised us? I would say concrete repairs is the most, but that's just the decay because it's so close to the sea. And also, we've had to try and marry the heritage and the new regulations together, which is difficult to do sometimes. Is that correct, Pat, again? Because, like, heights of handrails way back in the 30s, 40s are not what they're legal now. And if you're going to have public on the site, which are going to, we have to comply with the legal. So it's trying to marry the two together to get an agreement to what we can do to get around it, if we can get around it and still get it done and stuff like that. So
it looks like it's going to be incredibly modern in here, though. You know, it'll still keep its beautiful Art Deco features, but it looks like it's going to be a modern-day building.
Yeah, your lighting will be modern, but you'll still have the parts of the walls and all like that will look which was original. That is correct. That's correct. And same with the windows, will look original as well.
When you saw this site for the first time, what went through your head?
What went through my head? I remember when I was a little boy coming up here for a picnic. That's the first thing that came through my head. Because Mum and Dad used to take you up and you had a picnic at the start of the summer. And Tarlair was always where you come and you paddled in the pool. Okay? So I intend to be working on it. It's kind of went full circle a wee bit for me. But the weather has been against us on this project. That's one of the biggest things I've had, is the weather. Just at the end of the year, cut off about October, we've really struggled to get outside work done because of the weather, because you've got to have temperatures above 5 and rising for consecutive days for some of the materials that can be used and stuff like that. Also, it affects them. So it has been challenging rain. And this corner does get it. Monday we had the water lipping the door from the sea. Because of the high, it's just spring tide.
We've come upstairs and we're onto the roof of this building, which is going to become a terraced area, and you're maybe going to have seating here in the future, which will be lovely on a nice day. I know you've had a lot of challenges here to get to this stage, but you know, we're looking out at the pools just now, and you must feel quite excited.
It's exciting, and it feels much more positive because it's sort of past the stage now that can't go backwards. It has to go forwards, and it go forward in a really positive fashion, and everything's looking good. And it would be nice if the pools also
eventually
looking good. Yep.
You've got a few pools here. Just describe the layout.
We have, looking down from here, you would be looking down on the three pools, a perfect viewing point. The first pool is the one with the curved wall round about it. That's your toddler pool, the one that was once split into two between half sandpit, half paddling pool. The one surrounding that is your boating pool. And it was the one that had the little pontoon where all the little boats left from. And then the outer pool is their waved washed, competition-sized swimming, diving pool.
This pool didn't actually close until the 1990s, so many people have very happy memories of swimming here.
I think at the date was 1997, perhaps officially, but from the chap that used to lifeguard here, he'd said that the staff were all taken from here to the new BAM swimming pool, so it kind of didn't have an opportunity to continue even if anybody wanted to. And I think for a space of time, people did carry on coming down because it was their habit, if you like. And then eventually, because there was no cleaning of the pools being done, etc., then it had to be sort of closed completely.
But you do remember dipping your toe in here?
Just about my toe. It was a family thing to look from the top of the hill to see if there was a green patch left for us to spread our picnic blankets, and we were the professional picnickers while everybody else hit the cold water.
And there are some fabulous photographs of people swimming here.
Yeah, the people in the... Now, trustees, most of them swam here right through to their teens and never mentioned cold water, but at the same time, they say they wouldn't go in again now, but perhaps that's a good few years later on. But yes, lots and lots of people swimming. I can remember it, all the boats being occupied. I can remember them queuing for the boats in a little pontoon that was just in front of the pavilion there. And they had a variety of boat types, as far as I remember, the sort of pedalos, the ordinary rowboats and the kayak sort of styles, so that you could pretend that you were a kayaker, even if you weren't. And then the swimming pool, there was always people doing fancy stuff from the high diving board, and there was even a little chute at the shallow end.
So will we get back to it being like that, that kind of hub of the community?
You're going to have a facility, again, with a wee calf and the toilets and everything like that. And some places they go to, there's a beach and they go in wild swimming. For boys, I think this will be more a family thing. They'll come and kind of kiddies can be here in a little pool. Mum and dad can go into the bigger pool because if they like the outwater swimming. There's a lot of people that come down and visited when we were working outside and said they'd love to come back once it's all done and they can have a dip in.
Vincent Willicks and Pat Wayne on the eagerly awaited Tarlair Pavilion.
Yeah, it's such a bonny sight, isn't it?
It's a cracking sight, yeah. And I would love to see it. I would love to have seen it in its heyday. I'm not sure it's ever going to be technically feasible to actually restore it to as it was.
Yeah, but who knows?
But the pavilion,
Yeah, and I think it's going to look fab.
As you're probably aware, the fungal disease ash dieback is having a devastating effect on ash trees, not only in Scotland, but across Europe.
Yeah, as a result, thousands of mature trees are having to be felled for safety reasons. But at the same time, there's an attempt to secure the future of the species through the natural regeneration of potentially disease-resistant trees. So it's a bit of a juggling act, really.
Ash is a cracking wood. I mean, it's used to make a whole range of stuff from shinty sticks, flooring, axe handles, and as I discovered recently, the trim on a modest traveller. The potentially terrible situation with the dieback has prompted a project called Ashrise, which involves furniture makers and designers using wood from felled ash to make new items for a touring exhibition. Now, last year, or October 2022, I think it was, I saw the trees being felled, and recently I went along to the Scottish Wood Sawmill near Dunfermline to meet the makers who are actually choosing the milled timber. One of those was Angus Ross from Aberfeldy.
The use of ash is something that's very underutilised, I think, within the furniture-making industry generally. So it's great to see these projects where we're actually looking at it as a specific wood, rather than just looking at a sort of design or a commission or something. We're looking at the wood here particularly and trying to work out stuff that really uses its features to the best, really. So it's lovely to see the wood in this stage, really, and to get a feel for what there is and what we can do with it.
You know what you're going to be making. Can you describe it to me?
I do. I'm making a pair of chairs, really, which, again, with myself, a lot of steam bending in them, really. So we came down a couple of months ago before this wood had been completely dried, when it was still quite green, and I picked some of the wood for the steam bending aspects. And today I'm going to be looking for the wood that is, for the seats and for some of the rails and everything that needs to be kiln dried for the other parts of the chairs. And it's always good to come here because there's a lot of variation of timbers all around, really, sort of. So, and you know where they come from. I mean, this is all local stuff that Scottish wood have here, really, sort of. So that's always great to know, really. You can actually ask them and they'll tell you more or less where the logs are from, really. So.
I'm Jim Burley and I run Scottish Wood, which is this sawmill here. We're a hardwood sawmill and we work with homegrown, Scottish-grown hardwoods, oak, ash, elm, beech, sycamore, that kind of thing.
The trees that you actually, when I watched them being cut down, they came here. How would you assess them in terms of quality timber?
The timber is fine. Diseased ash is still good to saw. As long as it remains vertical and not lying in the grass, ash will go off quite quickly once it lies in wet grass. But we have over here a lot of ash trees that came from Hopetoun Estate that all were killed by ash dieback, and that's what we're cutting today. And that will make perfectly good timber.
Is this normal for you to have, you know, this many makers in one place, basically just swarming and they're not fighting yet over piles of timber? It's early days yet.
We do have groups here quite often, and we run courses here, but to have this many Scottish furniture makers here is a bit of a novelty. So we don't want a bomb landing among us because it'll destroy Scotland's heart of creativity.
Rebecca Kane, I'm from Edinburgh.
You've got your projects lined up already. You know what you're going to be doing. Would you describe it to me?
Yes. So I work with data, largely environmental data. Because tree rings have been upgraded based on weather, sort of like how wet the seasons are and warmth, like temperature, I'm going to use weather data from a station that it's situated about 7 miles away from where the trees grew. And I'm going to use, rain data, temperature and wind data to then recreate how those tree rings would look from the actual trees.
So you're not actually going to look at the planks themselves. You're going to start from scratch and design your own lock.
Yes. Yeah, to some extent. But then I'm going to use the wood to either create a wood block to print from, of the design that I create from data, or I'm going to print onto the wood. I'm still at the minute deciding what to do. I suppose my thing is I want to celebrate the wood. So if I'm going to just create a tool or the block from it to print from it, I'm wondering whether that's going to be in celebration enough of it.
And printing using what? Maybe using ink or paints or what?
Yeah, we were just talking about this, about actually creating ink from the wood as well. So using creating charcoal from the wood and then making ink from that to print with.
This is fabulous stuff. How about you, Kate?
I work with textiles. My plan is to use the bark to make a dye, hopefully, that I'll dye the back cloth that I'll also be making a block to print on the cloth. So I'm going to use sections of the ash to carve the blocks for printing as well.
Okay. And do you know what colour that dye is likely to be from the bark?
No.
Voyage of discovery time.
No, but it's in my compendium of dye plants that you can use for dyeing, right at the back in the section that says, and other plants that might give some colour.
Okay. So it's likely to be quite subtle, quite strong, what?
I've no idea, but usually the ones at the back of the book are yellowy brown.
Okay, yeah.
But beautiful yellowy browns, you know. You can't buy colours like the colours you make with natural dye, so...
No.
Yeah, it's exciting.
See, just standing beside this pile of timber here, I mean, you can look at the surface of this. You're looking at the grain. Look at this. You know, where basically there have been boring insects between the bark and the timber itself, and it's been beautiful, beautiful patterns.
Yeah. Like I said, I work with data, so it's finding patterns in data and translating those into patterns and design. And so it's all things like this that, yeah, the insect, like wildlife, has an effect on all these things, and it's, yeah, being able to tell stories, I suppose, from different means. But, yeah, the ash trees themselves are full of stories.
It's obviously milled really flat, and then as it dries, the tensions and compressions warp, but we'll run it through the planer and flatten it up, which will be fine. It's funny because at this stage it always looks a little bit grungy. It goes from being really beautiful, pristine boards and things straight off the mill, and then it's had a year nearly of air drying and then in the kiln, which warps it, and you get all staining and things from the moisture coming out. So it's probably the least glamorous looking bit at the moment, but soon.
It's quite nice to see ready-made patterns in it, though.
Yeah,
I quite like the blockchain.
So my name is Tom Addy, and I'm the maker and director of Tall Workshop near Braemar, and I am the instigator or the origin of the idea of Ash Rise project.
You've got something like sycamore, Tom, and you cut it. I mean, very often you end up with, what's it called again, spalling or spalding?
Spalting.
And I think it's like a fungal growth through the thing and what have you. It's almost as if someone has drawn
lines. I'm no scientist, but I believe the lines are in effect walls of defence that different types of fungi put up against each other. Basically, the tree's rotting. And the real art of the sawmiller is to halt that process. So as soon as you dry the wood, the fungi dies off, but the spalting, the lines and things are left in it, which is really beautiful.
Have you got a project in mind?
I don't, actually. So I came up with the whole project. It was my crazy idea. So from my point of view, there's an awful lot of creativity involved in the curation of this project, and I feel really, really honoured, touched, that my sort of slightly harebrained idea has inspired so many different makers across all sorts of disciplines, furniture makers of different styles, different types, but also, you know, makers of other things, other projects. It's really captured the imagination of an awful lot of people. I think we had upwards of 100 applicants for the 20 positions that we have. We're going to have this amazing collection of objects and artworks and furniture displayed in some amazing places throughout Scotland, really bringing the furniture making and, you know, and these other sort of disciplines to the masses, to the public all around the place. To see everyone here so enthused about picking up the wood is just really, it's really gratifying. It's really good.
Tom Addy, the man behind the Ash Rise project. And if you'd like to hear more about that, you can have a listen to the latest edition of Scotland Outdoors, available on BBC Sounds. And we will keep you posted about the final exhibition dates and venues, where we will all get the chance to see those objects. Should be around September time. I'm certainly very keen to get along and see what's being produced.
Yeah, sounds really, really nice. Time now to reveal our mystery sound. Let's have our final listen.
Okay, go for it.
loads of right answers.
Tons. Yeah. Absolutely tons.
What was the answer, Mark?
Well, you've got it, not me.
It's a sparrowhawk. We like to tie it in, weave it into our wonderful features, don't we?
Indeed, 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 indeed. So I came in this morning and the headsets were set up outside and I heard that sound and I thought, hang on a second, the peregrine falcons can't be back already, surely. But, you know, they're not away.
Loads of people getting it right. Jim in Motherwell, Andrew in Broxburn, Derek in Forth, Richard in Dingwall, Linda in Inverness says a male lives round here and visits my garden for snacks, scattering all the wee birds visiting.
Mm-hmm. Pamela from Edinburgh got it right. Scott and Nadia from Bothwell, Alison Midlothian, Margaret McAlpine, Neil Andrick, John McKenzie in Orkney, Jim Greensmith of Helensburgh, and Daniel in Forfar.
Yeah, Sean, Lindsay, it's my second attempt, admittedly, and then Stuart from Elgin. Loads and loads of correct answers in the end. Well done if you got it right.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, there's another comment here about seed tatties from last week. Elspeth in Kingoldrum says, love last week's show about seed tatties. We've had tatty shows here in Kingoldrum near Kirriemuir in what we believe is the oldest village hall in Scotland. Can I put a challenge out there to see if we're right, or do other villages lay claim to their village hall being older? We don't know.
We don't know, actually.
Well...
No, you go for it.
Well, we've got no time. That's the problem. As ever, we've run out. Don't forget, we've got a midweek podcast too. It's been a pleasure and a privilege, as ever, from all of the team here in Aberdeen. Thanks for listening.